intended to end, once and for all, a languid argument about the southern Alaskan boundary line. I have studied that question pretty thoroughly, and I do not think the Canadians have a leg to stand on. They were entitled to the few miles of coast that were theirs by treaty, and not a pebble more. This was the only issue dividing the English-speaking powers. Elsewhere there was benign assent. Britain seemed willing to accept the Monroe Doctrine, which Roosevelt, on the whole, held in greater reverence than the Nicene Creed. Lord Lansdowne's Foreign Office had forsworn any role, strategic or territorial, in the construction of a canal across Central America. The second Hay-Pauncefote Treaty, now at the point of ratification, approved American management of such a project and granted the United States exclusive right to fortify the canal. Roosevelt could claim a large share of credit for the latter clause. As governor, he had been outraged by the first Hay-Pauncefote Treaty, which had allowed for neutrality and openness of the canal in the event of war. His criticism had been outspoken and had hurt John Hay, but the Senate had agreed with him. Now there was this new, tougher treaty. It gave the United States Navy freedom to maneuver through the canal in wartime, while preventing other belligerents from doing so. He looked forward to signing it as soon as Hay laid it on his desk. There remained the question of where to build the canal, Nicaragua or Panama. Nicaragua was the overwhelming preference of Congress. Old John Tyler Morgan, chairman of the Senate Committee on Interoceanic Canals, had been croaking its praises for a decade. Roosevelt privately favored Panama, despite the failure of French engineers there. But his public attitude must be noncommittal. All he could urge now was that the canal be dug by American hands, and the first spade sunk during his presidency. The stupendous task was uniquely that of the United States. We must build the Isthmian Canal, and we must grasp the points of vantage which will enable us to have our say in deciding the destiny of the oceans of the East and the West. Otherwise, Germany might start digging. The thought of the Kaiser acquiring land rights anywhere in the Americas was enough to freeze Roosevelt's blood. A presidential committee was studying the choice of route, once and for all. It would probably recommend Nicaragua, and he would abide by its decision. Even so, Panama remained an attractive alternative. The isthmus was at its narrowest there, fewer than 40 miles from sea to sea, and his nature was to love shortcuts. There were rumors that the entire French operation, both equipment and excavations, would soon be for sale, and the political situation in Panama was promising. That reluctant appendix to Colombia was having one of its annual rebellions against the authority of Bogota, the 48th or 49th by Roosevelt's count. Since Colombia was itself waging war against Venezuela, there was a chance that, for once, Panama might succeed. If so, the rebels would surely offer their canal route to the United States in exchange for a share of revenue and guaranteed independence from Colombia. The Allegheny foothills turned black and greasy near Olean. Discarded oil drums dribbled into Cuba Lake. The very ground seemed to ooze. Here in 1627, Franciscan explorers had discovered a spring of thick, dark water that burned like brandy. Later settlers found this same crude seeping out of rocks all over the Alleghenies. They had cursed it as poison for the soil until Indians persuaded them it was medicinal. Roosevelt himself came from a generation of children who had been rubbed with evil-smelling rock oil whenever they had chest colds. Olean Valley now was a landscape inconceivable to its discoverers. The slopes bristled with filthy derricks and flaming chimneys. Double-headed pumps toggled crazily, sucking tarry sludge out of the earth. High in the sky floated an oily miasma that seemed to drain the world of color. Apocalyptic though the scene was, Roosevelt was aware of something more disturbing above and beyond it all, a new and dark power that shadowed every prospect in American life. The power had its source in a contract between executives of the industry he looked upon and the carrier transporting him. Nearly 30 years before, the Standard Oil Company and the Pennsylvania Railroad had pledged, "The party of the second part will pay and allow to the party of the first part rebates, and on all oil transported for others, drawbacks." Those simple words introduced a new concept, un-American to some, of privilege in commerce, bestowing rewards upon the large at the expense of the small. Both parties excused the contract by saying it would prevent loss or injury by competition. If they thus blasphemed against the gospel of free enterprise, Standard Oil, at least, was unrepentant. What, John D. Rockefeller wanted to know, was so holy about competition? Did it not lead to unrealistic rate-cutting, cycles of overproduction and depression, and needless duplication of services? What interdependent industries needed was less competition and more cooperation. Rockefeller's rebate privilege had been too flagrant to survive under law, but it was followed over the years by sophisticated arrangements to the same effect. Standard Oil had engulfed its smaller rivals, while the Pennsylvania Railroad made similar deals with other industries and became one of the richest transport systems in the country. Presidents Cleveland, Harrison, and McKinley paid little attention to the phenomenon of combination. To them, it seemed a natural economic trend. If industries produced vital supplies, if railroads functioned as semi-public utilities, why restrict their profitable development? Only slowly and locally had ordinary Americans, workers, consumers, and small businessmen, begun to feel the dark power growing. For combination's irresistible tendency was toward monopoly, and whatever corporate executives might say about increased efficiency and reduced waste, the historic inclination of monopoly was to raise prices and lower wages. Standard Oil had taken early steps to protect itself against common law suits, and in doing so had perverted one of the most sacred words in the legal vocabulary. It reorganized its component corporations into a trust, whereby all stocks were delivered to an independent board, which then operated the entire combination in unison. Congress had no power to quash this move. Within 9 years, John D. Rockefeller had entrusted himself with 90% of the oil refining business of the United States. His profits were so fabulous that other industrial giants had rushed to organize interstate trusts of their own. Congress, responding to public concern, had passed the Sherman Antitrust Law of 1890. It declared illegal every contract, combination in the form of trust, or conspiracy in restraint of trade or commerce among the several states. But the law was too comprehensive to be particular. Corporate lawyers, Elihu Root prominent among them, elaborated the trust concept into that of a holding company, chartered in one hospitable state, yet monopolizing related corporations throughout the nation. Holding company directors concerned themselves with questions of finance, so the lawyers argued they were unengaged in trade or commerce. The Supreme Court had agreed reluctantly with this argument and had ruled in U.S. v. E.C. Knight Company, 1895, that a trust controlling 98% of the nation's sugar refining business was legal, since refining was not itself an interstate activity. The depression of the mid-90s had cramped trust growth, but combination, aided by the spread of the telephone-telegraph web, resumed with a vengeance after the war with Spain. In 1898, there had been 20 multi-million-dollar industrial trusts. Now, there were 185. The proliferation evoked an image, in many minds, of a constrictive organism stretching out to every extremity of American civilization. Hence the title of Frank Norris's new antitrust novel, The Octopus. These trackside mourners of Olean Valley, staring blindly at Roosevelt as he whizzed by, how enmeshed were they? The oil trust paid their wages. Other trusts carpeted their houses, papered their walls, piped their water, sluiced away their sewage. Trust ice cooled them in summer. Trust wool warmed them in winter, as did trust whiskey. These men chewed trust tobacco and checked trust watches. These women baked trust flour and cooked trust beef in trust stoves full of trust coal. These children chewed trust gum and scribbled on trust slates. Roosevelt himself had trusts to thank for the starch in his shirt, the type on his newspapers, the glass of his window, the rails under his wheels. Poor dead McKinley, two cars back, was jiggling in a trussed coffin. What might a cynic make of that? Ideologically, Roosevelt was committed to a conservative view of the trusts. Personally, he felt a certain ambivalence. He saw grave dangers in unrestricted combination, yet he could not deny that the economy functioned better now that the trusts were, in effect, running it. The price of kerosene, for example, had been declining for 30 years, courtesy of Standard Oil. America was no longer a patchwork of small, self-sufficient communities. It was a great grid of monopolistic cities doing concentrated business with one another, steel cities and rubber cities, cities of salt and cloth and corn and copper. Just beyond these hills was a place that actually called itself Oil City. American exporters did not need a book of vouchers to dispatch one consignment across a rickety grid of independent railroads, each with its own timetable, rates, and reliability quotient. Now, one ticket sped 1 million tons to either coast on flawlessly synchronized trains. At every port, trust-operated ships were ready to ferry the consignment on. If freight charges were higher than they used to be, so was turnover, and so were profits. According to a recent survey, at least 65% of the national wealth was attributable to the trusts. That statistic did not even include the newest and most gigantic combination of all, Andrew Carnegie's merger of his steel company with 9 others. United States Steel, capitalized at almost $1.5 billion and feeding more than 1 million people, was virtually a nation in itself. Its income and expenditures approximated those of the Second Reich. It, too, had a Kaiser, an emperor of finance, and if today's newspapers were to be believed, Wilhelm II might soon cede him a portion of his realm. Mr. John Pierpont Morgan is trying to get control of the German steamship lines. Roosevelt liked Morgan. The solitary, bottle-nosed banker had been a friend of his father, and on that score alone merited affection. Even so, he did not know him well. Few did. Only Morgan's immediate family and the half-dozen handsome young aides who stood between him and the world, as if to screen his legendary ugliness, claimed that privilege. Governor Roosevelt had once denied Morgan tax exemptions on 2 railroads. He had tried to make amends with a testimonial dinner, an effort on my part to become a conservative man, in touch with the influential classes. But the financier remained unmollified. Roosevelt's last letter to Morgan had been answered by a secretary. So far, 1901 had been Morgan's annus mirabilis. Along with his new billion-dollar trust, he controlled several banks, including the International House of Morgan, the Western Union Telegraph Company, the Pullman Car Company, Aetna Life Insurance, General Electric, Britain's Leland Steamship Lines, and 21 railroads. Control, indeed, was his passion, not the constant clashing competition of the free market. As chairman of J.P. Morgan and Company, he handled more wealth than any other man on earth, and was capable of plunging the United States into a depression overnight, or rescuing it from one. Yet his greatest power derived from his integrity of character. One nod of the massive head was security for $50 million. One snort of the carbuncled nose was enough to sweep all opposition from his path. Review of Reviews saluted him as the most masterful personality in the country, perhaps in the world. But now there was a challenger to that title, riding to Washington on one of the few northeastern railroads Morgan did not control. Sooner or later, their personal trajectories must intersect, as sure as this Allegheny track was destined to run into those of the Susquehanna Valley. Roosevelt hoped that the confluence would be smooth. To his mind, the real threat posed by financiers such as Morgan lay not so much in their combination policies as in their virtual freedom, thanks to U.S. versus E.C. Knight, from federal regulation. Even President McKinley had talked of doing something about the trusts. Roosevelt himself had publicly warned, The vast individual and corporate fortunes, the vast combinations of capital which have marked the development of our industrial system, create new conditions and necessitate a change from the old attitude of the state and the nation toward property. More and more it is evident that the state, and if necessary the nation, has got to possess the right of supervision and control as regards the great corporations which are its creatures. He now stood committed to those words uttered only 2 weeks ago at the Minnesota State Fair. Morgan's philosophy was also on record. I owe the public nothing. If they were indeed set on a collision course, Roosevelt was determined not to be the one derailed. Morgan may be master of United States Steel, but he was master of the United States government, surely the greatest combination of all. National stability required that he maintain eminent right of way. Elsewhere in the train, Senator Hanna was slumped, cursing the day that William McKinley accepted Theodore Roosevelt as his running mate. Now look, that damned cowboy is President of the United States. Herman Colesot came back to tell Roosevelt about Hanna's despair. He suggested that the senator be treated with utmost delicacy, for he had the power to block all White House initiatives during the coming session of Congress. Roosevelt reacted blankly. What can I do? Colesot suggested a flattering supper adieu in the presidential car. At 11:04, the funeral train drew into Port Allegheny, Pennsylvania, and stopped for a while to allow platform mourners to look at the dead president's bier. Souvenir collectors laid nickels and pennies and flowers on the rails. When the wheels started to roll again, there was a crunching of coins, and the perfume of pressed roses filled the air. In future years, misshapen metal discs and bits of dried petal would remind the citizens of Port Allegheny of McKinley's last earthly journey. The steep climb up Keating Ridge began. At times the locomotive seemed about to stall. Shortly before noon, it dragged its payload over the crest and, with loud puffs of relief, entered a winding valley. Hills crowded in on both sides. Then one cut gave way to the shaft of a coal mine, and for a few seconds Roosevelt and his fellow passengers could exchange stares with 400 filthy coal miners. Boys, youths, and old men, were they really old or just toothless, stood bareheaded, leaning on picks and shovels, their small smudged eyes, only the creases showing white, squat bodies and tape-wrapped shins, proclaimed them to be Slavs. It was impossible to tell from their swarthy expressions whether the sight of a presidential cortege moved them or not. Implicit in the stare of those eyes, the power of those knobby hands, was labor's historic threat of violence against capital. Roosevelt knew that nowhere in America was the threat more real than in the Pennsylvania coal fields, the bituminous region he had just entered, and the anthracite region to east and south. Valley after valley, as the train snaked through, disclosed communities as squalid as any these people could have fled in Europe. Thousands of sooty shacks on stilts, with pigs tied below, gutters buzzing with garbage, mules clopping to the mine heads, hock deep in fine gray dust. Beneath that dust, men were scrabbling in wet, gassy gloom, earning a dollar and change for every ton of coal they hacked. If 1901 turned out to be a good year, they might get $500 apiece, about what Roosevelt had already earned as President of the United States. In cash, they would realize perhaps a third of that. Their wage packets were subject to compulsory deductions for rent, fuel, medical bills, and food, supplied at inflated prices by the company's store. As a group, they aged and ailed faster than any other workers in American industry. These boys began their careers at 8 or 9, picking splinters of slate out of the coal breakers until their hands were scarred for life. These men worked coal 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. They ate coal dust in their bread and drank it in their milk. They breathed it and coughed it. At 40 or 45, most were so ravaged by black lung disease that they had to return to the breakers to pick slate with their grandchildren, contracting fresh black scars until they died. Roosevelt understood enough about social repression to sense that today's contempt for the unskilled worker was tomorrow's likely revolution. Trade union membership had more than doubled in the last 5 years. Sullen miners personally fueled most of the nation's industrial machine. In his opinion, the labor question was the greatest problem confronting 20th century America, the most far-reaching in its stupendous importance. He had been saying so since the United Mine Workers, UMW, first struck the Pennsylvania anthracite mines in 1900. How worried Hanna had been that bloodshed might prevent McKinley's re-election. The senator had wheedled both sides to an interim contract. Today's New York Sun noted that this modus vivendi was to expire in 6 months. Passion was building in the pits. If the UMW was not soon recognized as a bargaining agent by the mine operators, the next coal strike could be violent enough to obliterate memories of the Haymarket riot. Roosevelt had been violently inclined himself in Haymarket days. He had fantasized leading a band of riflemen against the rioters and shooting them into submission. But middle age and the democratizing effect of war had moderated his attitude toward organized labor. Pillars of hemlock and pine rose on either side of the train, suffusing it in cool gloom. Here and there a shaft of light fell vertically, for the sun stood at noon, disclosing naves and transepts carpeted with needles, cloisters where deer and pheasants sought sanctuary from the hunting season. Roosevelt was more prone to revere such natural architecture than any Gothic cathedral. Trees were objects of deep spiritual significance to him, especially when they were full of birdsong. He had stocked the bare slopes of Sagamore Hill with elms and chestnuts and oaks and dogwoods, faithful to his family motto, Qui plantavit curavit. The jungles of Cuba had made a soldier of him. The forests of Wyoming had brought him solace after the death of his first wife. The piney air of Maine had cut and soothed the asthma in his teenage lungs. Further back still, in boyhood, were memories of summer nights in the woods, and the sound of a beloved bass voice reading The Last of the Mohicans under fire-reddened branches. I am sorry the trees have been cut down. Little T.D. Roosevelt had been 9 when he wrote that, after some minor act of vandalism in Georgia. As an adult, what was he to make of the wasteland he now began to see in Pennsylvania? The Allegheny Forest receded on both sides, leaving only stumps. Soon there was nothing but a fringe of trees on the highest ridges, beyond reach of any saw. Stumps, stumps, and more stumps perforated the landscape like arrows snapped off in death agony. Most were blackened. Local lumberjacks wanted white pines only. Less profitable trees could be burned like weeds. There were no saplings to be seen. With billions more trees beyond the horizon, replanting was a waste of time. Descent via Emporium Junction and Driftwood revealed even worse devastation. Roosevelt had foreseen just such sterility when governor of New York. Unrestrained greed means the ruin of the great woods and the drying up of the sources of the rivers. These hillsides, which for centuries had absorbed foliage-filtered rainfall, were now bare, gullied by direct precipitation. The courses running off them were choked with mud and dead fish. A town sign flashed by, Renovo. Edith had vacationed here as a child. The name, Latin for I renew, sounded mocking in these dying uplands of the Susquehanna. About the only renewal Roosevelt could see was a station repair yard where flat cars were being overhauled to carry away more and more trees. He understood, as most Americans did not, the tendency of transport and industrial combinations to consume the environments they served. United States railroads owned more timberland than all the nation's homesteaders. To him, conservation, a term just becoming politically fashionable, meant not only the preservation of natural resources, but the prevention of the monopoly of natural resources so they should inhere in the people as a whole. It was nearly time for lunch. Roosevelt ordered places laid for himself and the Secretary of War, and went to pay his respects to Mrs. McKinley. Ravaged, almost comatose with grief, she did not detain him long. By 1:30 he was back in his car, and the congenial company of Elihu Root. He felt at home with conservatives. Whether or not the term applied to himself, he owed his political advancement to men of Root's type, wealthy Republicans who belonged to the Union League Club, read the North American Review, and were coldly polite to butlers. More conservative rhetoric followed after lunch, as the other cabinet officers on the train came in one by one to see him. With the exception of Attorney General Philander Chase Knox, a polished little man of 48, they were venerable figures. There was his old boss, Secretary of the Navy John Davis Long, portly and lumbering at 63. Secretary of Agriculture James Wilson was 66. Secretary of the Interior Ethan Allen Hitchcock, 65. Postmaster General Charles Emory Smith, 59. Elihu Root was 56. The two absent secretaries, John Hay and Lyman Gage, were 62 and 65, respectively. McKinley had chosen carefully. A more orthodox phalanx of Republicans would be difficult to assemble. To a man, these conservatives believed in the sanctity of property and the patrician responsibilities of wealth and power. Their eyes were honest, but hard. Knox again the exception, with his veiled, astigmatic stare. They were accustomed to luxury travel on complimentary railroad passes and a myriad of other corporate privileges. They were prepared, in return, to give trust lords such as J.P. Morgan their favorable support in disputes between capital and labor or local and interstate commerce. They tacitly acknowledged that Wall Street, rather than the White House, had executive control of the economy, with the legislative cooperation of Congress and the judicial backing of the Supreme Court. This conservative alliance, forged after the Civil War, was intended to last well into the new century, if not forever. Senator Hanna was determined to protect it. Let well enough alone. Roosevelt was too restless and too reform-minded to heed such a motto. On the other hand, to use his favorite phrase, he despised the theorists who advocated radical change. Not for him, Eugene Debs's vision of a society purged of aggression, with all citizens pooling their assets in a state of torpid bonhomie. He tended toward a biological view of the common man as a brute, albeit capable, with encouragement, of self-refinement. Years of sweaty acquaintance with cowboys, policemen, and soldiers had convinced him that their instincts were benign, that greater social efficiency was as much their desire as his. All they needed was enlightened leadership. In a fundamental disagreement with social Darwinist thinkers, Roosevelt condemned that baleful law of natural selection which tells against the survival of some of the most desirable classes. His own field studies, both scientific and political, had shown him how populous species, whose competition was ferocious, advanced more slowly than those whose selection was determined by reasonable numbers and controlled by certain laws of behavior. As with guinea pigs, so with Slavs. As with lions, so with Anglo-Saxons. The United States, with 77 million citizens, was still uncrowded and healthily competitive, but its social balance would be threatened if poverty spread in proportion to immigration. Hundreds of Japanese coolies and thousands of dirt-poor Chinese peasants were arriving every month, boxed in barrels, buried under potatoes, sandwiched between bales of hay. The worst thing he could do now was let well enough alone. Somehow he must grant a little leisure and a little extra money to the multitudes currently working only to survive. This would enable them to develop those non-economic virtues, intelligence, unselfishness, courage, decency, which he loosely defined as character. Character determined the worth of the individual, and What is true of the individual is also true of the nation. At the same time, he must persuade Union League Republicans that perpetual, mild reform was true conservatism, in that it protected existing institutions from atrophy and relieved the buildup of radical pressure. All his life he had preached this doctrine. He would preach it louder now that he had universal attention. He might not have power yet to convert his cabinet, much less the Senate, but youth and time were on his side, and the presidency promised to be a bully pulpit. As if to reassure Roosevelt that the America of his dreams could be a reality, the exquisite town of Lock Haven rocked into view. Tall houses glowed white and apricot in the mid-afternoon light. Willows trailed their fronds in the glassy river. Quiet lanes divided schools and steeples and shops. Here was social order in the harmonious interdependence of rich and poor. Here was fecundity, symbolized by the women on every stoop lifting their babies to bless the new president. Here was industry in the form of an immaculate paper mill. And here, palpably all about, was morality. The fine white paper from that mill went under contract to Roosevelt's good friend Edward W. Bach, publisher of Ladies' Home Journal. Both men believed that the bourgeois domestic environment, efficient, loving, aesthetic, mother-controlled, was the nucleus of a perfect society. Although Roosevelt wished the journal would emphasize women's suffrage less and regular childbearing more. Girls softly pelted the train with flowers as it steamed through Lock Haven Depot. More girls with more flowers were waiting down the line at Williamsport. The locomotive stopped there briefly to take on water, and an invitation scrawled in childish capitals was delivered to Roosevelt's car. Unable to resist it, he stepped outside and bowed. A little boy yelled, "Hooray!" then burst into tears as an older girl smacked him for irreverence. The train jerked forward again, crossed the Susquehanna, and entered a broad landscape of harvest crops, orchards, and stone farmhouses. Thickening crowds at every level crossing announced the approach to Harrisburg. Urchins perched like starlings on telephone poles. Soon even haystacks bore teetering human loads. At 5:20, city buildings closed in. A crescendo of 10,000 voices singing, "Nearer My God to Thee," floated out of Union Station. Church bells, steam whistles, and several discordant bands joined in the din. Governor William Stone of Pennsylvania was waiting on the platform with an honor guard, but Roosevelt stayed aloof behind drawn blinds. Harrisburg was notoriously the most corrupt seat of state government in the nation. It was also a bedrock of orthodox republicanism. This posed delicate problems of executive strategy. If he wished to preserve his honest reputation, he could not identify too closely with machine politicians here. Yet to govern effectively, he had to cooperate with the machine's Washington representatives. Only 3 weeks ago, he had mused, "Were I president, I should certainly endeavor to do what the two Pennsylvania senators wished in matters of patronage, so as I honorably could." A messenger ran along the train with a telegram for Herman Colesot. It was a favorable reply from Secretary Gage to Roosevelt's plea for loyalty. Colesot jumped out and bought the evening papers. Riffling through them, he found the headlines he was looking for. Wall Street had reacted optimistically to the news that Gage and Hay might stay. Opening prices had soared 1 to 6 points higher than Friday's closing, and steadiness had prevailed throughout the market. A spokesman for the financial community called these signs clear and reassuring. Roosevelt was relieved to hear the good news. "I don't care a damn about stocks and bonds, but I don't want to see them go down the first day I am president." The tolling of church bells faded as the train moved on, but the singing did not. Thousands of black-clad mourners, crammed around Cumberland Valley Bridge, took up the threnody of McKinley's dying hymn. By now, the lugubrious tune palled on passengers who had listened to it ever since leaving Buffalo. For days to come, awake or asleep, they would hear voices crooning, "Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee." Their nerves, tightened by 72 hours of suspense, tragedy, excitement, and fatigue, began to fray in the waning daylight. Women burst into tears. Men grew morose, or, in the case of Senator Hanna, profane. "That damn cowboy wants me to take supper with him alone, damn him." Ahead in the press car, a group of reporters sat talking about death. They noticed a country funeral procession crawling darkly up the slope of a hill. It receded into the distance behind McKinley's beer. "What shadows we are," someone quoted softly, "and what shadows we pursue." The sun was setting, and its rays gilded the misty transpirations of peach orchards and tobacco fields. An old farmer, hearing the onrush of the train, climbed off his harrow and stood to attention, his red shirt incandescent in the horizontal light. Children ran to cluster around him. Their spindly shadows, leaping east, briefly stroked the wheels of Roosevelt's car. To eyes that had so recently gazed upon oil derricks and steel bridges and Harrisburg's jumbled housing, the little group looked quaintly anachronistic, a vignette of the past century. Though such families still accounted for 60% of the American population, their numbers were dwindling as combination crept across the countryside, leveling hedgerows and quintupling the size of farms. These very fiefs were already in fief to the Tobacco Trust. Departments of agriculture in state after state boasted the effects of the new scientific management. Kansas wheat production had increased to such an extent that some farmers there were calling themselves manufacturers. Review of reviews reported enormous sales of sophisticated agricultural machinery across the nation. An ultra-new combined header and thresher was being tested in California. 8 horses were needed to haul it. It advanced across a field of standing grain, miraculously leaving nothing behind but a row of stuffed sacks. Technological progress for big farmers, however, did not mean that life was any better for small. In the Midwest, nearly 3/4 of rural families lived below subsistence level. In the South, looming ever closer as Roosevelt rode, country people sought town jobs through the winter just to survive on fatback and hoecake. Roosevelt could see little relief for the rural unemployed in the immediate future. A place like York, Pennsylvania, flashing by redly at 5:45, was the typical country town, grown too big. There were more than 1,000 such cities across the nation. For its new poor, York offered only more poverty. A laborer might trade his hoe for a hammer for a few extra dollars a week, but the increment was meaningless, given urban costs. His children would still run barefoot through November, and in midwinter, their breath would be ice on their bedsheets. Even more wretched than these migrants were the immigrants from unsalubrious parts of Europe, further crowding American cities. Since January, nearly 500,000 had poured in. With their greasy kerchiefs and swollen cheekbones, they seemed content to live in any slum and do any work for pigs' wages. Not surprisingly, the native-born Americans they supplanted felt rage and ethnic contempt. Roosevelt's journalist friend, William Allen White, spoke for many in his syndicated diatribes against hunkies and Italians, the very scum of European civilization. Roosevelt was not immune to such sentiments himself. His youthful views on the inferiority of various ethnic stocks had been republished with rather embarrassing frequency. Yet he believed in America's ability to integrate all comers. One of his favorite stories was that of Otto Raphael, the young Russian Jew he had plucked from the Lower East Side of Manhattan and made a policeman. Roosevelt was the first president ever to be born in a large city. He welcomed the clash of alien cultures, as long as it did not degenerate into mass collision. As such, he saw no paradox in being an opponent of the xenophobic American Protective Association, and strong supporter of the Immigration Restriction League. But he felt that America's first responsibility was to its literate, native-born, working poor. Several thousand such citizens stood watching his train pass through the industrial outskirts of York, half a mile of humanity silhouetted against the sunset, dinner pails in hand. Then they were gone. Night closed in. For the next half hour, Roosevelt sat with his elbow on the window ledge, staring through his own reflection at the speeding darkness. The consistent features of the political landscape, as he saw it, were fault lines running deeply and dangerously through divergent blocks of power. Potential chasms lurked between isolationism and expansionism, government and the trusts, labor and capital, conservation and development, wealth and commonwealth, nativism and the Golden Door. And since the last election, the fault lines had widened. As William Jennings Bryan kept saying, the extremes of society are being driven further and further apart. Roosevelt thought he knew what was causing the underlying drift, a crumbling of government, the national bedrock. Some quick executive reinforcements, such as he always made when taking a new job, would slow the drift until the next election. Then, assuming he was the Republican Party's chosen candidate, he might campaign for more fundamental change. How, in the meantime, to care for those millions of Americans out there in the twilight? How to articulate their vague feelings that despite general peace and prosperity, something deep down was wrong with the United States? Here was his challenge as president, to put into speech and political action what they felt in their hearts but could not express. His appeal must be to neither reactionary nor radical, but to every man, the farmer in the red shirt. Signs were not wanting in September 1901 that every man was impatient, inclining toward revolution. From several western states came demands for direct voter participation in primary elections, direct election of senators, and a referendum system to permit citizens to pass legislation without the consent of their legislators. In Madison, Wisconsin, a Republican insurgent who called himself Bob had won the governorship on an antitrust ticket and was crying hoarsely for regulation of interstate railroad rates. In Cleveland, Ohio, a fat radical nicknamed Tom had captured City Hall and was bellowing threats against its private utility companies. Far-flung and lonely as these voices might sound to a trainload of old guard politicians en route to Washington, one passenger, at least, was acute enough to pay attention. He sensed that they might someday swell into a chorus, the first great political outcry of the 20th century. He must soon respond to it, or the farmer in the red shirt would vote for somebody else in 1904, and Theodore Roosevelt would go down in history as a president unworthy of power, forcibly retired at 46. Roosevelt's reverie was disturbed by Senator Hanna arriving for supper. While the two men ate and talked, the funeral train crossed the Mason-Dixon line. Black faces began to flash by, lit by the glare of watchfires. Up north, earlier in the day, there had been few such faces, maybe 1 in 50. Here in Maryland, the ratio was 1 in 5. Across the South as a whole, 1 in 3. Census statistics such as these meant various things to marketers, sociologists, and geographers. To Roosevelt and Hanna, they reduced down to one vital political fact. Whoever commanded the loyalty of Southern blacks commanded the Republican presidential nomination. The South was Hanna's chief source of political strength. No matter that he himself represented Ohio. No matter either that the Republican Party in Dixie was so weak that in some state legislatures it had no seats at all. What did matter was that the South was disproportionately rich in delegates to national conventions. Hanna's expert cultivation of these delegates and his control of party funds as chairman of the Republican National Committee had guaranteed the two nominations of William McKinley. In his other role as senator in charge of White House patronage, he had been a rewarding boss, showering offices and stipends upon the faithful. As long as the South continued to send delegations of these blacks north every 4 years, Mark Hanna would remain party kingmaker. For a moment, just one moment, 2 days ago, Hanna had seemed vulnerable, but Roosevelt's vow of fidelity to McKinley's policies reconfirmed his power. The new president must continue to consult him on matters of Southern patronage, as the old had done. And consultation, given Hanna's mastery of the system, implied consent rather than advice. Such a partnership might be good for a party weakened by assassination, but it was hardly desirable for Roosevelt as a presidential candidate in 1904. Grotesquely, the next Republican nominee could be Hanna himself. Uncle Mark did not look like a vote-getter at 63, with his arthritic limp and huge, melancholy eyes. Yet he was loved and respected by both business and labor. Even Roosevelt found Hanna's burly, coarse-fibered honesty attractive. To consolidate his presidency, therefore, he must quietly build up a Southern organization of his own. He had, in fact, already sent an urgent summons to the nation's most influential black leader, Booker T. Washington, of Tuskegee, Alabama, asking him to come north for patronage consultations. "Theodore," said Hanna, perhaps reading his mind, "do not think anything about a second term." At 7:20, the train pulled into Baltimore. Flowers, handkerchiefs, gloves, and Bible pages cushioned the sound of its slowing wheels. The catafalque was gently detached from the rear of Mrs. McKinley's car and shunted forward for the last stage of the journey. As soon as it was coupled, the train began to move again, serenaded by a choir of 2,000 Negroes. They sang the inevitable dirge, but the tenderness of their voices was such that both words and melody regained full poignance. At least one passenger felt that it was the sweetest music he had ever heard. An hour later, the lights of Washington came into view. Loeb helped Roosevelt into a dark Prince Albert coat and gave him the black kid gloves and silk hat he had worn in Buffalo. Crepe was tied around the presidential sleeve. There was neither clanging of bells nor singing when the locomotive nosed under the shed of 6th Street Station at 8:38. Silence filled the cavernous space. Even the crowd outside stood hushed, listening for the final groan of brakes. All personnel on the platform were military or naval, with the exception of two elderly gentlemen in top hats, John Hay and Lyman Gage. Their black clothes made a somber contrast with the glitter of braid and swords all around them. Beside them paced the portly figure of Commander William Sheffield Coles, Roosevelt's brother-in-law and host until such time as Mrs. McKinley vacated the White House. As usual in moments of high drama, Roosevelt delayed appearing. For nearly a quarter of an hour, the cabinet waited in a semicircle around his car, and anticipation mounted on the platform and in the street. At last, a few minutes before 9, he came down the steps, jaw set sternly. The military guard presented arms. Roosevelt shook hands with Hay and Gage and whispered the urgent word, "Stay," in the former's ear. He made it clear this was an order. Hay could not decline nor even consider. Then he marched on, his cabinet following in double file. 5 Secret Service men appeared from nowhere and clustered about him. Ignoring the crowd at the station entrance, he took command with the natural ease of a colonel of cavalry. "Divide off, divide off." He waved a black-gloved hand at the cabinet officers. They formed 2 facing ranks. Roosevelt joined Hay on the right-hand side. There was a pause, and onlookers barricaded behind the gates were able to contrast his features with those of Senator Hanna. Roosevelt's face was lined with fatigue, but looked harsh and strong. Hanna's was pitiful, full of despair. Soldiers and sailors approached with the coffin on their shoulders. The crowd uncovered, and taps broke the silence. Then, just as the coffin was sliding into the hearse, there was a flash from a window across the street, accompanied by a revolver-like crack. Roosevelt flinched. What was that? A photographer, said Commander Coles. Something should be done with that fellow, Roosevelt muttered savagely. For a moment, in his nervousness, he forgot he was president, and gestured Hay and Gage into his carriage ahead of him. They demurred. He climbed in, taking the rear right seat. The secretaries followed with Commander Coles. A little colonel jumped up on the box, yellow plumes waving. Ahead, to the sound of trumpets, the hearse began its journey to the White House. Roosevelt's carriage rolled off a few seconds later. Thousands of spectators watched it disappear into the warm Washington night. The First Administration, 1901-1904. Chapter 1. The Shadow of the Crown. I see that Titty, President Titty, here's his health, is the youngest president we've ever had, and some of the papers are wondering whether he's old enough for the responsibilities of the office. The epigraphs at the head of every chapter are by Mr. Dooley, Theodore Roosevelt's favorite social commentator. On the morning after McKinley's interment, Friday, 20 September 1901, a stocky figure in a frock coat sprang up the front steps of the White House. A policeman, recognizing the new President of the United States, jerked to attention, but Roosevelt, trailed by Commander Coles, was already on his way into the vestibule. Nodding at a pair of attachés, he hurried into the elevator and rose to the second floor. His rapid footsteps sought out the executive office over the East Room. Within seconds of arrival, he was leaning back in McKinley's chair, dictating letters to William Loeb. He looked as if he had sat there for years. It was, a veteran observer marveled, quite the strangest introduction of a chief magistrate in our national history. As the president worked, squads of cleaners, painters, and varnishers hastened to refurbish the private apartments down the hall. He sent word that he and Mrs. Roosevelt would occupy the sunny Riverview suite on the south corner. Not for them, the northern exposure favored by their predecessors, with its cold white light and panorama of countless chimney pots. A pall of death and invalidism hung over the fusty building. Roosevelt decided to remain at his brother-in-law's house until after the weekend. It was as if he wanted the White House to ventilate itself of the sad fragrance of the 19th century. Edith and the children would breeze in soon enough, bringing what he called the Oyster Bay atmosphere. At 11 o'clock he held his first cabinet meeting. There was a moment of strangeness when he took his place at the head of McKinley's table. Ghostly responsibility sat on his shoulders. A very heavy weight, James Wilson mused, for anyone so young as he is. But the president was not looking for sympathy. I need your advice and counsel, he said. He also needed their resignations, but for legal reasons only. Every man must accept reappointment. I cannot accept a declination. This assertion of authority went unchallenged. Relaxing, Roosevelt asked for briefings on every department of the administration. His officers complied in order of seniority. He interrupted them often with questions, and they were astonished by the rapidity with which he embraced and sorted information. His curiosity and apparent lack of guile charmed them. The president's hunger for intelligence did not diminish as the day wore on. He demanded naval construction statistics and tariff reciprocity guidelines and a timetable for the independence of Cuba, and got two visiting senators to tell him more than they wanted to about the inner workings of Congress. In the late afternoon, he summoned the heads of Washington's three press agencies. This being my first day in the White House as President of the United States, Roosevelt said ingratiatingly, I desire to have a little talk with you gentlemen who are responsible for the collection and dissemination of the news. A certain code of relations, he went on, should be established immediately. He glanced at the Associated Press and Sun Service representatives. Mr. Boynton and Mr. Barry, whom I have known for many years and who have always possessed my confidence, shall continue to have it. They must understand that this privilege depended on their discretion as to publication. Unfortunately, he could not promise equal access to Mr. Keene of the United Press, whom I have just met for the first time. Boynton and Berry jumped to their colleague's defense. Roosevelt was persuaded to trust him, but warned again that he would bar any White House correspondent who betrayed or misquoted him. In serious cases, he might even bar an entire newspaper. Berry said that was surely going too far. Roosevelt's only reply was a mysterious smile. All right, gentlemen, now we understand each other. Much later that evening, after a small dinner with friends in the Coles House on N Street, the President allowed himself a moment or two of querulousness. "My great difficulty, my serious problem, will meet me when I leave the White House. Supposing I have a second term." Commander Coles, replete with roast beef, sank deep into leather cushions and folded his hands over his paunch. He paid no attention to the cataract of talk pouring from the walnut chair opposite. For years he had benignly suffered his brother-in-law's fireside oratory. He was as deaf to Rooseveltian self-praise as he was to these occasional moments of self-doubt. How like Theodore to worry about moving out of the White House before moving in! The commander's eyes drooped. His breathing grew rhythmic. He began to snore. "I shall be young, in my early 50s," Roosevelt was saying. "On the shelf, retired, out of it." Two other guests, William Allen White and Nicholas Murray Butler, listened sympathetically. Prodigies themselves. White, at 33, had a national reputation for political journalism, and Butler, at 39, was about to become president of Columbia University. They were both aware that they had reached the top of their fields and could stay there for another 40 years. Roosevelt was sure of only 3.5. Of course, the power given him dwarfed theirs, and he might win an extension of it in 1904, but that would make its final loss only harder to bear. So Butler and White allowed the President to continue lamenting his imminent retirement. They interrupted only when he grew maudlin. "I don't want to be the old cannon loose on the deck in the storm." Undisturbed by the clamor of younger voices, Commander Coles slept on. Quiet settled over Washington that weekend as the government resumed its interrupted vacation. With Congress not due back in town until December, there was little to detain anyone who could afford to leave. Lafayette Square was deserted. Office seekers, those perennial mosquitoes whining around the body politic, were mercifully few, thanks to mass appointments by Hanna and McKinley earlier in the year. Roosevelt waved away unsatisfied applicants, saying that he was in mourning, but he knew that they would return in ever-increasing numbers. Nothing could stop the natural attrition of federal jobs by resignations, retirements, and deaths. Nervous tension still afflicted him at unguarded moments. "You ought to be ashamed of yourself," he roared at a boy who tried to photograph him leaving church. Later, on a twilight stroll with Lincoln Steffens, his fantasy about being attacked recurred. He demonstrated just what he would do with his fists, feet, and teeth if another Chalgosh came out of the shadows. "What I sensed," Steffens recalled, "was the passionate thrill the President was finding in the assassination of the assassin." By Monday morning, Roosevelt had calmed down enough to perform his duties with dignity and dispatch. "Here is the task," he wrote Henry Cabot Lodge. "I have got to do it to the best of my ability, and that is all there is about it. I believe," he added, with the naivete that had always endeared him to his friend, "you will approve of what I have done and the way I have handled myself so far." The presidential suite was now ready for occupancy. Reluctant to spend his first night there alone, he sent a telegram to his younger sister, Corinne, inviting her and her husband, Douglas Robinson, to be his guests. They came down by express train from New Jersey, and Commander and Mrs. Coles joined them for dinner en famille. Roosevelt was in a nostalgic mood. His thoughts kept reverting to Theodore Sr. "What I would not give if only he could have lived to see me here in the White House." Later, when decorations from the table were distributed as boutonnieres, the president received a sophronia rose. His face flushed. "Is it not strange? This is the rose we all connect with my father." For a moment, T.D., Bammy, and Pussy were children again, clustering around the broad, bright man who had always worn a yellow flower in his buttonhole. "I think," said Roosevelt, "there is a blessing connected with this." 2 evenings later, a carriage drew up outside the White House. The moon had not yet risen. Not until a boy and a girl tumbled into the light of the portico did reporters in Lafayette Square realize that Edith Roosevelt had arrived. True to her reticent fashion, she came under cloak of darkness. There was a moment of hesitation before she emerged, a comely figure draped in black. Her exquisite profile, usually cast modestly downward, tilted as she followed Kermit and Ethel up the steps. She brought no other children. Little Archie and Quentin were coming with their nurse. Ted had gone straight to Groton, and Alice, the eldest and most independent, would find her own way to the Capitol. Kermit and Ethel vanished into the vestibule and reappeared clinging to their father. Careless of watching eyes, he threw his arms around Edith, then escorted her inside for supper. Over the next few days of official mourning, Washington correspondents were starved of substantive news and covered Kermit and Ethel as if they were visiting royalty. The latter's negotiations with ground staff on the subject of white rabbits was treated by the Washington Post as a diplomatic dispatch. "It is understood that the high contracting parties are about to reach an agreement, the only point of difference being that of the assignment of territory to the rabbits. A protocol is likely to be signed tomorrow." Official Washington smiled as more children and more animals joined the Roosevelt menagerie. The White House police were particularly disarmed, allowing Archie and Quentin to march in their morning parades, and looking the other way as Kermit carved huge slices out of the lawn on his bicycle. Alice, naughtily hiding out in Connecticut, kept everybody guessing. At 17, she already had her father's instinct for delayed entrances. Distracted as the reporters were with family gossip, they missed the secret visit of a black man to Roosevelt's office late on the night of Sunday, 29 September. It was unlike Booker T. Washington to be so furtive. He was a world-famous figure, revered even by white Southerners, and had visited William McKinley in broad daylight. But fame had made him cautious. Privately, he admitted to grave misgivings about Roosevelt's telegram from Buffalo. The president must not expect him to be an automatic ally in any strategy to dismantle the Southern patronage system wrought by McKinley and Hanna. Washington's resistance did not last long. He was impressed by how frankly Roosevelt stated that he did not intend to appoint a large number of colored people to federal office in Dixie. That would only worsen racial tensions there, currently exemplified by a lynch rate of about 100 hangings per year. Better to name just a few exemplary blacks, concentrating instead, with Washington's approval, on the very highest type of native Southern white man, regardless of political influences. He, Theodore Roosevelt, was the first president to mingle Union and Confederate blood. As such, he wanted to see the South back in full communion with the North. Washington listened, darkly impressed. Here was a candidate desperate for delegates in 1904, yet willing to gamble on a patronage policy of quality rather than quantity. Indeed, if Roosevelt was to be believed, to appoint members of the opposite party when necessary. For 40 years, Republican executives, aided by Grover Cleveland, had imposed Northern reform on the South, with the result that white Democrats there were almost totally alienated from the federal civil service. Divided as they might be into gold and Bryanite factions, they were united in their fear of the fecund Negro. Only the most rigid segregation, they believed, could save them from all becoming mulattoes. State by state, Southern legislatures were disenfranchising Negroes. By the next presidential election, not one black man in 1,000 would be eligible to vote. Washington understood that it made little sense for Roosevelt to elevate many Negroes in areas where they were unwelcome at the ballot box. Every new black postmaster licking stamps, every tax assessor asking uppity questions, would fan the flames of Southern race hatred. And the flames were not metaphorical. Just the other day in Winchester, Tennessee, a maddened crowd of whites had burned a black man at the stake and sold slices of his roasted liver. Washington, whose political agenda was as unsentimental as Roosevelt's, if considerably more veiled, agreed to help create a new Southern majority of moderate white appointees, plus a minority of blacks. The president, in gratitude, promised an identical patronage policy in the North. This effusion might have bypassed most ears, but Washington caught its significance. No other president had ever appointed a black official above the Mason-Dixon line. None had considered the feelings of franchised blacks in such states as New York, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. Surely this was proof of Roosevelt's enlightenment. After leaving the White House, Booker T. Washington headed south via Virginia, where he had been born a slave 45 years before. One of the first things he could remember was the sight of his uncle being strapped to a tree and screaming under the lash of a cowhide whip, "Pray, master, pray, master." The half-coherent cry still rang in his ears, convincing him of the white man's urgent need to be regarded as superior and the black man's equally urgent need to accommodate that fantasy on pain of extinction. Washington's pale gray eyes and tawny complexion further sharpened his consciousness of white lust, white guilt, and white hatred, as his mother had endured the embraces of some nameless white man, or men. So must he endure the contempt of rednecks and the paternalism of rich Yankees. Present passivity was future power. For 16 years he had been urging his fellow Negroes to accept disenfranchisement as inevitable, to concentrate instead on educational and vocational self-improvement. Blacks and whites alike, with the exception of extremists at either end of the color spectrum, accepted this as the only practical solution to the color problem. Washington's famous simile, "We can be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand, in all